Right now, you are trusting your life to a gap so small that, well, it's measured in nanometers.
Yeah, it's honestly crazy to think about.
I mean, whether you're driving across a huge towering suspension bridge, or, I don't know, riding in an elevator or sitting on a 400-ton freight train, the only thing keeping you safe isn't giant steel beams. It's actually microscopic stripes.
Right. It completely flips your perspective on engineering, really.
Yeah.
You start to realize that this macro world, you know, the world of skyscrapers and global infrastructure, it's entirely dictated by microarchitecture, stuff you can only see with an electron microscope.
Exactly. And that is our mission for this deep dive. Today, we are cracking open a really dense stack of metallurgical research, academic theses, technical study guides, and they are all focused on one incredibly specific topic, perlite in steels.
It's a fantastic collection of sources to go through.
Yeah, and by the end of this conversation, looking at everyday infrastructure is going to feel like you suddenly developed X-ray vision. You are going to see the invisible structures doing all the heavy lifting right beneath your feet. So, okay, let's unpack this, because if you are not a material scientist, perlite sounds like, I mean, an exotic gemstone, right? Not the unseen force keeping the Golden Gate Bridge from snapping. So, in plain English, what actually is perlite?
Well, it does sound romantic, I'll give you that.
Yeah.
But it's not a gemstone. And it's not actually a standalone metal either.
Oh, really?
Yeah, perlite is what metallurgists call a phase. So to understand how it forms, you have to sort of picture iron at incredibly high temperatures.
Like glowing red hot in a forge.
Exactly. When steel is forged and glowing like that, the iron inside it is in this active phase called austenite. It's symbolized by the Greek letter gamma.
Okay, austenite, gamma. Got it.
Right. And in this high temperature state, carbon atoms are just comfortably dissolved inside the iron. It's very much like sugar dissolved in hot tea.
So as that hot austenite cools down, the temperature drops and the iron just can no longer hold on to all that carbon. The sugar starts crashing out of the tea.
That's exactly it. That thermodynamic shift forces the metal to physically separate.
Yeah.
It just can't stay in that uniform high temperature state. So it organizes itself into a really highly structured microscopic pattern.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it creates a lamellar structure, which just means it splits into two different phases that stack together in these alternating microscopic layers.
Right. And the sources outline these two layers really clearly. One is cementite, which is an iron carbide with the chemical formula Fe3C. And that is incredibly hard, but also very brittle.
Yes, very brittle on its own.
And then sandwiched right next to it is a layer of ferrite, symbolized by the Greek letter alpha, which is a much softer, more ductile phase of iron with a lot more give to it.
Precisely. So you have millions of these alternating layers forming the perlite structure. Mm-hmm. Hard cementite, soft ferrite, hard cementite, soft ferrite.
It's basically a microscopic layer cake.
A very strong layer cake, yes.
Or, actually, you know, it reminds me of plywood. You take thin sheets of wood, which on their own might be flimsy or prone to snapping along the grain, and you glue them together. You combine something stiff with something that has a little give, and you end up with this ultimate supermaterial that's vastly stronger than its individual parts.
That plywood analogy is spot on. The composite structure is exceptionally strong. And our sources highlight that researchers are now using these really complex computer programs specifically to calculate the interlamellar spacing of these layers.
The interlamellar spacing.
Yeah, meaning the literal physical distance between the hard cementite and the soft ferrite.
Wait, so if the computer programs are spending massive amounts of processing power just to calculate the gap between layers, is that tiny space the actual secret to how hard the steel gets?
It really is.
Because looking at the research, you see phrases like, quote, restricting the movement of dislocations within the crystal lattice, end quote, which sounds like heavy jargon. How does a layered gap physically stop a steel beam from bending?
What's fascinating here is how metallurgists actually view bending and breaking. Metals don't just bend all at once.
They don't.
No, at the atomic level, they bend because of these things called dislocations.
Okay.
Think of a dislocation like a wrinkle in a really large area rug.
Oh, I hate when that happens.
Right. And if you try to drag the whole rug across the floor all at once, it's way too heavy. But if you just push that little wrinkle from one side of the room to the other, you can move the rug bit by bit.
Oh, wow. That's a great way to picture it.
Yeah, in metal, when those atomic wrinkles move freely, the metal bends.
So the alternating layers of perlite act like heavy furniture placed all over that rug. The hard cementite layers are physical barricades. The atomic wrinkle travels through the soft ferrite dough, hits the hard cementite wall, and just gets stuck.
Exactly. And that is why interlamellar spacing is the defining factor of strength. If you pack those layers tighter together, creating what we call fine perlite, you put the barricades closer together.
Which means the wrinkles have absolutely nowhere to move.
Correct. The steel becomes significantly harder and stronger. You tweak the distance between those microscopic layers by fractions of a nanometer, and you literally change how an entire steel cable behaves in the real world.
And suspending massive weights in the air is where this microarchitecture truly holds up the world. Because of that alternating plywood structure, you can draw this perlitic steel out into long wires that possess phenomenal tensile strength. They can withstand an immense amount of pulling force without snapping.
The sources dedicate extensive documentation to this. These perlitic cables are deployed on the Millau Viaduct in France, which is the tallest bridge in the world.
Wow.
Yeah, and they hold up the Golden Gate Bridge and the Bay Bridge in the U.S. You'll find them on the Millennium Bridge over the Thames in London, the massive Akashi Kaiki Bridge in Japan, suspension bridges in Busan and Taiwan. They're even used in heavy-duty steel cranes operating in Cambridge.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. I was looking through the source material, and it mentions cutting-edge marvels like the Millau Viaduct, sure, but it also mentions perlitic ropes used on an obsolete bridge across the Rio de la Plata in Argentina.
Yes.
If this iron carbon layer cake is so naturally flawless, why does the chemical recipe need to change depending on the bridge? Like, isn't the basic iron and carbon combination enough?
Well, the basic binary perlite, which is just iron and carbon, is incredibly strong, yeah.
Mm.
But massive modern infrastructure demands a lot more.
Okay, so how do they upgrade it?
Metallurgists use ternary steel. That means introducing a third major component or alloying element like manganese or silicon. And they aren't just adding ingredients for the sake of it. They're actually altering the kinetics of the metal.
By kinetics, do you mean the literal speed at which the red-hot austenite cools down and separates into those layers?
Yes, exactly. When you add an element like manganese or chromium, it acts as an atomic roadblock during the cooling process. It slows down the carbon atoms as they try to separate into layers.
Oh, I see.
By precisely controlling that speed, metallurgists manipulate that crucial interlamellar spacing we talked about.
Right, the gap.
Yeah. The research extensively covers the growth rate of ternary perlite. This is how they engineer extremely fine perlite for maximum tensile strength. They can also create alloy perlite designed for extreme corrosion resistance.
Which makes sense, especially when you consider our sources document studies on perlitic cables exposed to harsh, salty coastal winds for over 40 years.
Exactly. You need that tailored recipe to survive those environments.
But, you know, suspending a bridge is ultimately just a test of holding still, right? The cables are champions of static tension. You pull them and they hold. But the real nightmare for a metallurgist isn't static weight. It's violent, continuous friction.
Oh, absolutely.
And you don't find that in the sky. That takes us from the clouds down to the railways.
Yeah, railway tracks rely on wear resistance and managing what engineers call contact mechanics. The sources actually detail a major project funded by the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council, specifically focused on rail research in the UK.
Right. The metallurgical side of this was spearheaded by Dr. John E. Garnham and Professor Claire L. Davis at the University of Birmingham. And Garnham actually wrote his 1995 PhD thesis at the University of Leicester on the wear of perlitic steels.
He did, yeah.
And the chemical composition for the rail steel they tested was incredibly specific. I'm looking at it here. It's 0.5% carbon, 1.10% manganese, and 0.24% silicon.
Right, along with a whole alphabet soup of trace elements. You've got 0.03% chromium, tiny fractions of nickel, molybdenum, copper, aluminium, titanium, nitrogen, and oxygen.
That is wild. Every single fraction of a percent is calculated to bind the atoms in a way that resists that grinding friction.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Crucially, the sources note this rail steel was subjected to a very specific heat treatment to minimize something called allotriomorphic ferrite.
Okay, so the study guide glossary breaks down allotriomorphic ferrite as a form of ferrite that lacks a regular crystalline shape.
Right.
Why is that specific irregularity so dangerous for a train track?
Well, think back to our plywood analogy. The immense strength comes from the regularity of those alternating layers of hard cementite and soft ferrite reinforcing each other.
The structured barricades.
Exactly. A luxuriomorphic ferrite is basically a pocket of soft ferrite that forms in an irregular blob-like shape.
A blob?
Yeah, without any of the hard cementite walls running through it. It's a totally unreinforced zone.
Uh-oh.
So under the extreme crushing stress of a freight train, those irregular soft blobs will deform or crack long before the layered perlite does. The heat treatment is explicitly designed to eliminate those microscopic weak links before the steel ever leaves the foundry.
And the stress they put the steel under to test those weak links is terrifying. I mean, they took 47 millimeter diameter discs, just 10 millimeters wide, and used line contact testing to subject the metal to a maximum contact stress of 1,500 megapascals.
So an unbelievable amount of force.
And it wasn't just crushing pressure either. The test included a negative 1% slip between the contacting surfaces.
1,500 MPa concentrated on a tiny line of contact is astonishing.
So what does this all mean? If you take your hands and press them together as hard as you possibly can, that's the 1,500 MPa. But if you just hold them there, they're mostly fine. The negative 1% slip means that while applying all that crushing pressure, you were also constantly sliding one hand slightly against the other.
Right.
If you did that, your hands would blister and tear apart in seconds. That is exactly what a massive train wheel is doing as it screeches against a curved steel track. It's simultaneously crushing the microscopic layers and tearing them sideways.
And that combination of downward force and lateral slip is what creates deformed perlite. The mechanical wear eventually crushes those beautiful alternating layers into just total chaos.
It sounds brutal.
It is. But what's deeply fascinating about Garnham and Davis's methodology is how they simulated this environment. The procedure actually involved 500 dry cycles of brutal metal-on-metal wear, followed immediately by cycles lubricated with distilled water.
Wait, why add distilled water after 500 dry cycles of torture? Are they just trying to simulate a rainy Tuesday on the British railways?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the water fundamentally alters the physics of the wear through hydraulic pressure.
Hydraulic pressure? How?
When those layers of perlite deform, microscopic cracks begin to open up under that 1,500 Encal stress. When you introduce water, that fluid seeps deep into the tiny fractures.
Oh, man. So the weight of the train wheel then rolls over that water-filled crack.
And it essentially turns the water into a microscopic crowbar.
A crowbar?
Yeah. The immense weight compresses the fluid inside the crack. And because water doesn't compress easily, it exerts hydraulic pressure outwards, violently forcing the crack to tear deeper into the steel.
Wow. So it accelerates the propagation of the damage.
Exactly. Leading to entirely different wear patterns than dry friction alone. They were meticulously studying how environmental lubrication chemically and physically compromises this painstakingly crafted microstructure.
It is a literal microscopic war zone down there on the tracks. But understanding how perlite breaks down under pressure allows metallurgists to actively hack the microstructure, right? Once you know how the layer cake is baked, you can start looking for ways to change its behavior entirely.
Oh, definitely. The sources detailed truly radical methods for altering perlite. Like we said, the rigid layers provide phenomenal strength, but sometimes you don't actually want ultimate rigidity.
When would you not want it?
Well, if you need to cut the steel to manufacture complex gears or intricate engine components, that layer cake will just destroy your cutting tools. That's where a process called spheroidization comes in.
Spheroidization. It sounds like turning something into a sphere.
You nailed it. It is a specific, prolonged heat treatment that takes those long, flat, rigid layers of hard cementite and forces them to break apart and ball up into little spheres distributed randomly throughout the soft ferrite.
Wait a minute. If we use spheroidization to turn our highly engineered layer cake into basically a microscopic chocolate chip cookie, where the hard cementite is just spheres floating in the soft ferrite dough, doesn't that completely ruin the plywood strength effect that holds up the Golden Gate Bridge?
This raises an important question about the fundamental philosophy of material science.
Okay.
There is no single best structure. There are only structural trade-offs. So yes, if you spheroidize the perlite, you absolutely obliterate its tensile strength. It would be catastrophic for a suspension bridge cable.
Because you lose the continuous sheets.
Right. In the plywood analogy, the continuous hard sheets distribute the weight. But if you turn those sheets into spheres, A microscopic crack can just navigate straight through the soft ferret dough, easily tearing around the hard chips. You lose the structural wall.
But you gain machinability. Mm-hmm. Because the structural wall is gone, industrial drills and lathes can slice right through that soft dough without shattering their blades on the hard cementite layers.
Precisely why they do it. You hack the structure to fit the exact job you need.
That is brilliant.
Duh.
And the hacks detailed in the sources get even stranger. They mention divorced perlite, forced perlite, and magnetically induced perlite.
Yeah, the field is pushing some crazy boundaries.
The one that really caught my eye was from video recordings of a meeting mentioned in the text called Adventures in the Physical Metallurgy of Steels. They showcased experiments applying electrical pulses directly to the steel to actively influence its microstructure.
That's a fascinating area of research.
But how does a zap of electricity rearrange solid steel without melting it down first?
It relies on a mechanism related to electromigration and atomic vibration. Instead of just heating the metal in a furnace and waiting for thermal kinetics to dictate how the atoms settle, they hit the solid metal with high-energy electromagnetic pulses.
Okay.
These pulses act like a microscopic sonic boom sweeping through the material.
A sonic boom for atoms.
Yeah. They violently vibrate the iron's crystal lattice, temporarily giving the trapped carbon atoms just enough kinetic energy to slip out of their current positions and arrange themselves into new formations.
That is unbelievable. They are using electromagnetic energy to manipulate phase transformations in real time. Like they are coaxing atoms into new patterns without even altering the chemical recipe.
It represents a massive leap in interacting with metal. It opens entirely new frontiers for creating highly specialized steel variants on demand.
It is pure mastery over the material world.
It really is.
But what I love about this source material is that it shows this mastery isn't purely industrial. It isn't strictly reserved for crushing train wheels, hanging bridge cables, or manufacturing gears. The exact same hyper-engineered material also serves as a medium for pure aesthetic expression.
You're referring to the section on nanostructured perlite in art.
Exactly. Hidden deep within these dense technical documents, about 1,500 MPa stresses and allotriomorphic ferrite is a reference to a 1989 sculpture at the University of Manchester. It's called the Chrysalis. And it is constructed entirely out of endless perlitic steel rope.
It's a rather striking contrast to the rest of the engineering data, isn't it?
It's a beautiful contradiction. Yeah. You have this exact same hyper-engineered nanostructured perlite, a microarchitecture designed to withstand the most brutal, punishing forces human industry can generate. And it's sitting quietly on a university campus as an artistic centerpiece.
It perfectly synthesizes everything we've been discussing today. Perlite represents an incredible intersection of profound physics, brutal human utility, and creative expression. The same interlamellar spacing that guarantees a commuter train stays safely on the rails is the exact same microscopic canvas used to sculpt a piece of enduring art. It proves that understanding the fundamental building blocks of nature doesn't just let us build stronger things, you know, it lets us build more beautiful things too.
I couldn't have said it better. And I think that brings us full circle on our mission. We started by talking about developing X-ray vision, and I sincerely hope that is what you take away from this deep dive.
Let's do it too.
We have zoomed all the way from...
And as you think about that invisible layer cake, I'll leave you with one final lingering thought based on the research we've unpacked.
Oh, please do.
We know from the Adventures in Physical Metallurgy meeting that simply applying intense electrical pulses can fundamentally vibrate the iron lattice, alter perlite's microstructure, and change its strength.
Right.
If our structural steel is genuinely that sensitive to electromagnetic manipulation at the atomic level, what hidden impacts might be massive naturally occurring electromagnetic events like extreme lightning storms or severe solar flares be having on the nanostructural integrity of our aging rail lines and suspension bridges right now?
Wow. Now I'm going to be thinking about solar flares the next time I'm suspended halfway across a river.
Something to ponder.
Definitely. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll catch you next time.